should call on the Arab states to stop any effort to normalize ties with Israel. We want urgent measures by the international community to stop the bloodshed in Al-Aqsa Mosque.
The tension has also been fueled by an eviction plan in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, where Israeli settlers have waged a lengthy battle to take over Palestinian homes. Meanwhile, Palestinians held demonstrations in Ramallah and Gaza to denounce Israel's efforts to forcefully evict Palestinians from their homes in Al-Quds. Israel's Supreme Court was to hold a hearing on the eviction on Monday, but the session was postponed due to the unrest in Al-Quds. Israeli violence has sparked international condemnations. Meanwhile, the UN chief has urged Israel to exercise maximum restraint and respect the right to freedom of peaceful assembly. Amid soaring tensions in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, which has seen weeks of clashes, the Israeli authorities question whether a new uprising can now be inevitable. Unabating protests across the occupied territories have proved that Jerusalem, Al-Quds, is a red line for Palestinians, and they will always defend it with all means possible. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
No more silence. Say a word. Pro-Palestine activists gathered outside the UN office in Tehran to demand that the United Nations take action with regards to Israel's expulsion of Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah and other areas in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Mostly student, the protesters called the Israeli move barbaric and against all international laws.
I'm here to support Palestinian rights. As for the recent crimes against humanity, these aren't recent. These have been around for a long time. It's more than, nearly 70, 75 years that the ethnic cleansing of Palestine has been an ongoing process. This needs to stop. And more people need to stand up to Israel and to the crimes that they're committing. We need to talk about this and we need to stop this.
We have come here to voice our solidarity with and support to our brothers and sisters in Palestine and to condemn the inhumane behavior of the Israeli regime against Palestinians. We regard the UN silence as complicity in the crimes committed by Israel.
Israeli forces have over the past days been attacking Palestinian homes in East Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, trying to force the Palestinians to abandon their residences in an attempt to make way for the construction of new illegal settlements. The regime has so far wounded dozens of Palestinians protesting against the decision made by an Israeli court.
During the past days, we have witnessed heinous crimes against the innocent Palestinian people by Israel. It's interesting that the U.S. claims to be the defender of human rights. I wonder why is Joe Biden keeping mum and not condemning the Israeli violence? Where did all the human rights slogans go?
Israel has for 7 decades been pressing ahead with the construction of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories and continues to deny millions of Palestinian refugees the right to return. Several attempts have been made to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the last of which was the so-called deal of the century, proposed by ex-U.S. President Donald Trump, which is dismissed by Palestinians as an attempt to trade their identity and history with money.
Rights activists here say Israel's recent atrocities are a proof that the so-called peace plans by the West cannot defend the rights of Palestinians and will only make the Israeli regime more insolent in its crimes in Palestine. Protesters say it's time to take action, as any silence by the international community is tantamount to a green light to Israel's violence against Palestinians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A lot of work is needed and time is limited. That's what Joseph Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief, has told a ministerial meeting in Brussels with respect to ongoing talks in Vienna to try and save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal.
It's an effort to make the US to go back to the agreement in order to have a full compliance for Iran, which is the best way to ensure the exclusively peaceful nature of Iran nuclear program.
Tehran insists it has zero ambition to build a nuclear bomb. The idea that Iran wants a nuclear weapon is peddled by Tel Aviv and the Israel lobby in the US, according to unbiased security experts.
Where is the evidence, they ask? How many times has Washington launched attacks on foreign nations without any justification?
Critics say the West's meddling in the Middle East has caused immeasurable damage.
Well, the biggest failing of all was the, you know, intervention of the United States into Iraq, you know, after 9/11, because this created a security vacuum.
EU and US foreign policy was recently debated in the European Parliament.
We must work for stability in Iran and Iraq and Lebanon, a peace in Syria and Yemen, and oppose the US-Saudi attempts to isolate Iran.
The Iran nuclear agreement, underpinned by the UN, was thrown into flux when Donald Trump pulled the US out of the accord 3 years ago this month. He then imposed harsh, illegal economic sanctions on Iran. Saving the nuclear deal would help to bring stability to the region, it has been suggested.
You know, Middle East, it is a vital area. We should to make it a quiet area because, you know, it is on the middle of the trade road, so it will affect all the economy situation in all the world.
Joseph Borrell has told EU foreign affairs ministers the talks in Vienna, Austria, are extremely delicate, sensitive and intense. He says he's optimistic and a window of opportunity will stay open until the end of this month. Nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, he insists. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Malaysian Prime Minister Mohiuddin Yassin announces third nationwide lockdown as coronavirus cases soar, health system buckles and new variants take lethal hold. We now present you an article written by Niall Bowie. The piece is titled Malaysia Locks Down to Preempt India-like Crisis. Malaysia is set to begin its third nationwide lockdown following its deadliest week on record since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Prime Minister Mohiuddin Yassin announced that the entire country will be placed under Movement Control Order or MCO restrictions from 12th of May to 7th of June during a televised address on Monday, 10th of May. The Malaysian Premier, who in March had previously ruled out imposing a third Movement Control Order or MCO, said there are now COVID-19 variants that are more infectious, whilst the capacity of the public health system is becoming more critical. There are also weaknesses in COVID-19 protocol compliance by some. These factors demand that the government take drastic action. Health experts say inadequate early detection testing is to blame for the surge of increasingly severe coronavirus cases nationwide, which has intensive care units across the country at full or near capacity, a situation that threatens to tilt towards an India-like health crisis. The country's most recent seven-week lockdown, enacted from January to March to combat the deadly third wave of coronavirus that began last year, saw daily cases initially taper down but then surge again by early April. The disease's effective reproduction number, or RT, has been above 1.0 for more than a month consecutively, pointing to exponential recent growth. Active cases have more than doubled since mid-April, increasing from around 15,000 cases to more than 37,300 cases. According to the Ministry of Health in Malaysia, cases of severe infection requiring treatment with oxygen or ventilators are rising and impacting younger people, leading to an all-time high of more than 400 patients in the intensive care unit over the last week. Malaysia detected its first case linked to India's highly contagious B.1.617 variant of coronavirus earlier this month and has banned flights to and from India. The World Health Organization, WHO, named the strain a variant of concern on 10th of May, with it being one of four mutations linked to a more transmissible form of the pneumonia-like disease. Malaysia's Ministry of Health has also detected variants from the United Kingdom and South Africa among its community cases, mutations that it says are partly to blame for a 35.2% rise in severe symptoms from January through to April. A record high total of 150 people died from COVID-19 in the first week of May, along with the highest ever number of patients on ventilators. Total cases since the start of the pandemic now stand at about 444,484, with over 1,700 deaths recorded, leaving Malaysia with the third highest infection rate in the region, behind Indonesia and the Philippines. With hospital bed capacity at its limit across the country, Malaysian authorities appear to have resorted to a third movement control order, or MCO, as a last-ditch effort to buy time for the healthcare system. The announcement of another nationwide lockdown was unexpected given that the government previously said it would only utilize target lockdowns going forward, with Johor Bahru and parts of Selangor State, as well as the capital Kuala Lumpur, each being recently placed under area-specific MCOs for up to 2 weeks. Given the economic damage from two prior lockdowns and tranches of stimulus spending that have strained national finances, Putrajaya has been reluctant to impose heavier restrictions following the second Movement Control Order, or MCO, even turning down requests by state governments for tougher curbs due to concerns that economic activity would be adversely impacted. The government has seemingly found itself in a loop of prematurely relaxing virus-curbing restrictions for economic reasons, while thereafter showing hesitancy to undertake nationwide MCO measures in response to rising number of outbreaks, only to announce a new lockdown when hospitals are at full or near capacity. The lockdown falls a day before Eid al-Fitr, a religious holiday observed by Muslims to mark the end of the holy fasting month of Ramadan. About 60% of Malaysia's 32.7 million people are Muslims. House visits and customary visits to grave sites have been made prohibited for the second year in a row under COVID-19 restrictions. Kuo Swee Heng, a Malaysian physician specializing in health policies and global health, warned during a May 10th webinar organized by think tank ACES Malaysia that super spreader events typically linked to gatherings, risk setting off a chain reaction of events that would overwhelm an intensive care unit capacity and the healthcare system at large. Kuo Swee Heng said, the current landscape in Malaysia right now can tip into disaster very, very quickly, and no amount of resilience would really be able to prepare us for something that could be a disaster. The physician added, if we don't want to become like India, for example, or Italy in March of 2020, then we have to be aware that there are many ways for us to tip over. Among the risks he cited were political or economic black swan events that could undermine the government's pandemic response, as well as a slow vaccination rollout that leads to an immune escape situation whereby previously infected or immunized people become susceptible to reinfection as a result of more contagious mutant variations of the virus. Malaysia began its vaccine rollout in February with the Pfizer-BioNTech and Sinovac shots, but has only managed to inoculate just over 2% of the total population with two doses of the vaccine, or fewer than 680,000 people. The government aims to immunize 80% of the population by December of this year, a target that would ostensibly not be met at the current pace of uptake. Malaysian authorities have rolled out an early warning system designed to preempt potential infection clusters at identified locations, which sends a notification to members of the public to avoid flagged sites and seek early testing if they have visited places with high rates of projected transmission. The Hospital Identification Dynamic Engagement, or HIDE, system, which was unveiled by the Malaysian government earlier this month, uses artificial intelligence and big data collected through check-in entries under government's My Sejahtera contract tracing app to determine where outbreaks may occur. The vaccine rollout of the new system has been bumpy, though, as authorities issued conflicting statements over whether premises flagged by HIDE or the Hotspot Identification Dynamic Engagement would be ordered to close down. Opposition lawmakers have questioned the government-made system's methodology and raised concerns that it could create unintended negative consequences for businesses. Most of the flagged sites so far have reportedly been shopping complexes and shopping malls, and some critics have called into question by arguing that workplace clusters involving factories, palm oil plantations, learning institutions, private companies, and government agencies have accounted for more overload cases since the start of the pandemic. Pediatrician Amar Singh believes Malaysia's current level of testing, around 80,000 tests per day, is too small to make an impact as cases continue to soar. He says the issue is the government's use of slow but reliable reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction, or RT-PCR, tests rather than quick but less accurate rapid antigen tests, or RTK-AG. He said the rapid antigen tests, RTK-AG, may have a lower accuracy but makes up in speed and impact, recommending that RT-PCR, or the reverse transcriptase polymerase chain reaction, tests only be used for hospital admissions. Mass testing, experts argue, enables the early detection and treatment of cases, while late detection leads to overcapacity and a higher rate of deaths, the likes of which Malaysia is now experiencing. Amar Singh, in a statement submitted to Asia Times, said, "A COVID-19 disaster is looming in Malaysia, and we watch the numbers rise steadily. If the current wave escalates, our death services may have difficulty coping." The statement added, "We're also not getting an upper hand on the outbreak. It would be foolish to think that we cannot reach a state like India, as India is in today."
Ramadan.
Ramadan.
Joshua, and I converted to Islam in 2005 when I chose the name Mahdi for my Islamic name. I was very interested in different cultures and religions and new things that you cannot find in a country like Germany. I had a friend who was from Pakistan who owned a shop. One day in the month of Ramadan, the month of fasting, I was invited by him to his mosque. When I came to that mosque, there were several leaflets and books, also a few Qurans, which I looked at. And one Quran that I found was translated to German. When I started reading the Quran, it made me a lot calmer. I thought to myself, if you accept the hereafter, and if you accept the, if you accept that there is one God, and that there has to be a God, then why don't you want to convert to Islam? My first experience of fasting was not in the month of Ramadan, but it was in the month of Rajab, which comes before Ramadan. I started my fast, and I couldn't do it. I had to break the fast in the afternoon at around 3 or 4 o'clock because it was so hot and it was so difficult for me to fast without drinking. I was not even hungry, but the heat and the fact that I didn't drink any, that I didn't drink anything for almost 12 or 11 hours was pretty difficult for me, and it made me break my fast on that day. But I remember the first day of Ramadan in the same year, I did the whole month of Ramadan.
Ramadan is the ninth month of the lunar Islamic calendar. The visual sighting of the crescent moon signals the beginning of Ramadan, which lasts 29 to 30 days. In this month, Muslims fast from dawn till dusk and are encouraged to dedicate a portion of their day to prayer, reading their holy book, the Quran, and reflection. Iran's holy city of Qom has been a hub for Islamic schools and scholars for centuries. The Faizieh School is the most important Islamic school in the world and one of the oldest in Iran. Many prominent scholars of Islam studied here and are now teaching here themselves. Many of them have been influential in interpreting the Quran. Fasting is practiced in other religions like Christianity and Judaism as well.
Fast is just about going without.
Yvonne Ridley is an activist who has reverted to Islam.
Of course, there is fasting in Christianity, but it's more symbolic now. Both Moses and Jesus fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and we're told that they went without food and water. It was really quite a marathon. Christians in the run-up to their Easter go through a period of fasting called Lent, in which they give up something. Quite often it's something like cigarettes or chocolate, so it's quite symbolic, and it's not the daily test that Muslims put themselves through by simply not eating, not drinking, avoiding confrontational situations, having no physical sexual contact and the like.
Mm-hmm. Leila is an American living in Iran who converted to Islam years ago. She says Islam gave her life direction.
At the time, I was actually searching for a purpose in life, a goal, a direction in life. I knew that Christianity, I was Christian, didn't give me the answers that I really wanted. It wasn't specific enough for me. I wanted something that gave me a reason for why we're here, a purpose. And I liked Islam because it is the most complete religion, and there is a rule or a prescription or a goal for everything you do, an explanation. And that suited what I was looking for.
When Muslims fast, they refrain from eating and drinking all the daylight hours. For a first-time faster, this is a challenging experience, especially when they have to go to work as usual, rain or shine.
Basically, for me, it was a very strange experience. It was sort of exciting, but a little bit difficult to start with, because as you're first starting to fast, you've never really experienced this, not having this ability to, not being allowed to eat or drink anything all day long. So it was a very unique experience the first year. I was wondering at the beginning, I had a doubt if I would be able to actually fast that, because it was more like late summer, fall, and I had a doubt as well if I would be able to fast the number of hours, because I hadn't ever done it before. And after the first two or three days of adjusting to it, you realize that it's very easy, and you actually look forward to fasting. So it was a little bit of excitement, apprehension a little bit. Can I do this? Can I not do this? How does everybody else do it in a warm climate? You know, just a lot of questions for me to start with for the first time. But as the days went by and you get into this routine, you realize how easy that Allah makes it for you when you fast. It's not difficult, and you learn for the right reasons.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. O my Allah, for thee I fast, and with the food thou givest me, I break the fast, and I rely on thee.
There are certain things a person who is fasting must not do, but they are only the physical aspects of what's going on within the person's heart and mind. In Islamic countries, the fasting month is a national event, and everyone's in the Ramadan spirit. Naturally, this makes fasting more enjoyable and not eating or drinking more tolerable. But in secular countries, it might be more difficult to fast. Europe has more than 44 million Muslims, and the Americas has around 5 million.
I started my fasting at 4 o'clock in the morning, and of course my family, they are going to be hungry at 12 or 1, and they are going to want to eat their lunch. So in a way it's quite difficult, especially when you are not used to it, to see people eating in front of you and you yourself having to wait. But I think in un-Islamic countries, one thing that converts habit to is that they see all these things happening. They see the most un-Islamic things happening in their countries, in their homes, in their cities, that once they have it, it is easier for them to do a fasting compared to a person who was born a Muslim in an Islamic country or un-Islamic country. So people get used to that. People get used to it, to see people in the streets drinking ice-cold water or eating delicious foods, and you're fasting.
It's quite a difficult time for converts to Islam in the West. Very often their families don't support them or are almost hostile to their reversion to Islam. And because there is so much excitement to the build-up for most Muslims, sometimes converts can get forgotten about, and so they have to cope on their own, and it can be quite a difficult time for Muslims.
Muslims don't only fast during Ramadan. Some also fast voluntarily on the 13th, 14th and 15th of Rajab, the seventh month of the lunar Islamic calendar. Muslims spend 3 days in the mosque praying. It's a form of spiritual retreat called i'tikaf that the Holy Quran and Hadith recommend. This year, lots of students came to the mosque in the University of Tehran to perform their 3-day i'tikaf. There is also a social aspect to fasting. Community spirit and unity are an important part of Ramadan. Millions of people stop eating at one precise moment and start eating again with the sound of the azan. People give alms to the poor and visit family and friends in the holy month to break their fast together.
I think Islam gives us this opportunity to fast once a year to increase that awareness, that heightened sense of your neighbors and community and society, and that ability to help others becomes more aware during Ramadan, because then we begin to feel what sometimes our neighbors are feeling, whereas we may be so busy the rest of the year that we're not aware of that, or we take it with a grain of salt, as we would say. We know it's there, we know it exists, but we still go on with our daily lives.
It is a time for great reflection, and it's a time when you think of brothers and sisters across the world and how they spend their Ramadan and how they spend their fasting. And of course, for a large section of the Ummah, hunger is no stranger to them. There are brothers and sisters out there who survive maybe on just one meal a day, especially in places like Niger, which is often blighted by famine.
The fasting month has some very important nights, the most holy being the nights of Qadr. Muslims believe 1400 years ago on these very nights, the Holy Quran was revealed in full to Prophet Muhammad. Muslims pray and read the Joshan Kabir, Joshan Sagir, and Mujir, among other prayers. They believe they are more likely to be answered on these nights.
This Ramadan, during Laylat al-Qadr, which is indeed a very holy night, or three very holy nights, I would like to ask God for curing many issues that have happened in the world, such as the wars in countries like Syria, or people losing their jobs in any part of the world. But one personal thing that I would like to ask is for forgiveness, because I think that every person, even if he tries not to commit a sin, is not able to not commit a sin, because we're not mas'oom. We are not unfailable. We are human, and human do mistakes. And if people do mistakes and they regret their mistakes, they do not repeat them. So I think it's a good occasion to ask God for forgiveness and to not repeat those mistakes, and keep the connection to God that you have re-established in the holy month of Ramadan in the first 20 days and in the last 10 days of that month.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Wastewater tracking was used before the pandemic to monitor for polio and illicit drug use, but interest in the field and its applications has now ballooned, says Frida Cryer, researcher, in an article titled, "The Myriad Ways Sewage Surveillance is Helping Fight COVID Around the World." Stay tuned for more. From the subarctic community of Yellowknife, Canada, to subtropical city of Brisbane, Australia, scientists in more than 50 nations are now monitoring the spread of SARS-CoV-2 in sewage. The number of sewage surveillance programs tracking COVID-19 has exploded during the past year from a dozen or so research projects to more than 200, following the discovery that whole virus particles and viral fragments are shed in feces. The information garnered is helping scientists to track down cases, predict surges, identify where to target testing, and estimate overall numbers of infected people in cities or regions. Although sewage surveillance has been used for several decades to identify polio outbreaks and target immunization programs, and more recently to detect illicit drug use, the pandemic has brought new focus and investment in it as a means of tracking public health. There was always an interest in wastewater epidemiology, but now it's taken flight, says Anna Maria Do Rota Hausman, an infectious diseases researcher at the Netherlands National Institute for Public Health and the Environment in Beeldhoven. Since early 2020, SARS-CoV-2 sewage projects have taken off around the world as wastewater experts pivoted to concentrate on the crisis. But the scale and focus of surveillance programs varies, depending on how severely countries or communities have been hit by the pandemic. Scientists in Hong Kong are monitoring sewage in apartment buildings to find undetected infections. And in Yellowknife, Canada, health officials are testing wastewater to discover which viral variants have made it to their city, just 400 kilometers from the Arctic Circle. One common application of such surveillance program is as an early warning system. People who are infected start shedding virus fragments a few days before they show symptoms. And Dero the Husband uses this project to predict hospitalization numbers a few days ahead of time. Other groups are using wastewater to find and suppress outbreaks on a much smaller scale. At the University of California, San Diego, scientists test wastewater from 343 buildings around campus to check for signs of infection. Whenever a sample comes back positive, the university sends targeted messages to engage students housed in infected buildings to get tested and isolate. "You just can't afford to test 10,000 students each day," says Smriti Karkian, an environmental engineer at the university. Wastewater tracking provides a cheap and effective alternative, catching up to 85% of cases on campus. A similar system is in use in Hong Kong, where signs of SARS-CoV-2 in the wastewater of two apartment buildings led to mandatory testing of all residents in January. According to the South China Morning Post, the early warning system helped health officials to find 9 asymptomatic cases. Scientists in Australia, where COVID-19 cases have remained relatively low throughout the pandemic, are also using wastewater tracking as an early warning system. In Queensland, wastewater samples are collected across the state and sent to a lab in Brisbane for analysis. But tiny case numbers present Australian researchers with a unique challenge. The typical way for researchers to collect a wastewater sample, explains David McCarty, a water quality engineer at Monash University in Melbourne, is to take a bottle on a rope to a section of a sewer or a treatment plant and throw it in. But he says we're looking to maybe 1 or 2 COVID cases in a million people. The chances of missing those cases with that technique are really high. Instead, Australian scientists have turned to other methods of sampling. Passive samplers use gauze or another absorbent material that can be left in wastewater for up to 4 days, increasing the likelihood of it picking up virus fragments from that 1 in a million case. McCarthy has developed a small torpedo-shaped passive sampler that can fit into narrow pipes. The blueprint is open source, and it's been downloaded in countries including Indonesia, New Zealand, and Canada. An interest in the sewage surveillance stretches beyond academic circles to policymakers. "We met with ministers last week, and they were excited," McCarthy says. "That would never have happened before the pandemic." Elsewhere, governments and institutions have adopted pre-existing wastewater tracking methods to monitor larger trends in the numbers of cases across cities and neighborhoods. One country leading the charge is the Netherlands. Samples from wastewater treatment plants allow researchers to estimate how many people in large populations are infected with SARS-CoV-2, and government officials use these estimates to make decisions about whether to implement lockdowns and how to channel resources. Thank you. However, more than 70% of Swedish surveillance programs are in high-income countries, which have poured resources into wastewater epidemiology. Many researchers in the developing world are struggling. Testing in India incredibly challenging as Swedish systems are fragmented, says Sudipti Arora, an environmental scientist at the Dr. B. Lal Institute of Biotechnology in Jaipur, India. Only about one-third of all towns have sewer networks, she says. Consequently, slums and rural areas remain largely untested. In two of the country's northern states, her team is testing hospital wastewater for SARS-CoV-2 as part of a study into whether specific disinfectants inactivate the virus, as well as samples from wastewater treatment plants, to determine if the method can be used more widely in India. Despite the challenges facing the method in India, Arora and her team plan to use the experience they have gained with sewage surveillance during the pandemic and apply it to detecting other infectious diseases, as well as antibiotic-resistant bacteria in wastewater in the future. Many scientists working in the field say that a rare positive outcome of the pandemic might be that it will normalize the use of wastewater to monitor public health, whether for future pandemics or to track other health indicators such as hormones that indicate stress or levels of caffeine consumption. Wastewater epidemiology was under the radar, says Karkian. Now it's come to the forefront. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing National Birds, directed by German filmmaker Sonja Kennebec. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him, we have Dan Glazebrook, who's a journalist, political analyst, and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, National Bird follows the harrowing journey of three US military veteran whistleblowers determined to break the silence surrounding the US's secret drone war. Tortured by guilt for their participation in the killing of faceless so-called suspects abroad, and despite the threats of being prosecuted, these three veterans offer an unprecedented look inside this secret program to reveal the haunting cost of the US's global drone strikes.
You literally just kind of hover, and you would wait until he walked out to the field to meet with some friends for something, and you'd blow him up. Drop a Hellfire missile on him. Maybe we killed our objective, maybe we killed a guy who we thought was our objective. You don't know.
When I first got into the military, I was thinking it was a force for good in the world. I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was.
I still have a top secret clearance, so I have to be extraordinarily cautious about what I can and can't say on camera.
My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, and identify everything.
Adolescent near the rear of the SUV.
That's deceptive. You get the opinion that you're at 10,000 feet, you see this photograph, you know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. You know what you see in two dimensions.
You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them.
It's too easy. They just embolden commanders.
Let the party begin.
Because there is no threat.
Oh, sweet target.
I mean, this could grow to get so out of control.
Somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door shoved FBI badges in my face.
The Espionage Act is one of the most serious charges you can level against an American.
That I'm probably going to get indicted and I'm probably going to get charged.
I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program. It's a secret program. I can't just go telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, it's frightening.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Sonia Kennebec, the director, she won an award for this documentary with the Nation Institute. And she said in her award acceptance speech that she initially set out to make this documentary solely just about drones and drone warfare, but then it developed into something much more than this. Of course, we learn of the stories of the three characters in the documentary, and she wanted to focus also on the consequences of whistleblowing and espionage and all these sorts of issues. And Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, you can always tell there's something in the air, both literally and figuratively in this case, when filmmakers start making films about the same kind of thing. So in recent years, we've had three or four movies on the subjects of drones. We've had this, we've had the documentary called Drone, which is a slightly more arty and abstract version of this story. But we've also had feature films like Good Kill with Ethan Hawke as a drone pilot and Eye in the Sky, a British film with Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren. So there's clearly something going on that filmmakers, they want to be a part of this conversation. And I think part of the situation is that we are still all, we're all making our way through this moral maze at the moment. We're all dealing with the ramifications of drone technology. We're trying to figure out what the consequences are, the good points and the bad points. And I think filmmakers like Sonia Kennebec here, they all want to have a say in that conversation.
And of course, as you said, there's been a resurgence in this topic of drone warfare and the moral obstacles around it. And we've had, this documentary had Wim Wenders as the executive producer, of course, is a multi-winning, award-winning German filmmaker. How much impact do you think he had in this documentary?
Well, he's one executive producer, and he, you know, Wim Wenders in the past has had an interest in surveillance technology. He made a very interesting film at the end of the last century called The End of Violence, which is about surveillance technology in America as it was back then, and obviously things have moved on very rapidly from that. The other executive producer is Errol Morris, who is, you know, a revered documentarian, and has made things like The Fog of War in the past. So he himself is also very interested in this subject matter. So it obviously helps a young up-and-coming filmmaker when you can get two great filmmakers, two revered filmmakers with the industry, to put their names on the credit of the film. And, you know, it all ties in with some of the work they've done in the past.
And Dan, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on National Bird?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but to be honest, I find this quite often with films on this subject, the tendency to focus on the emotional turmoil of the operators and really the perpetrators. I find, to be honest, slightly distasteful, really, given that the primary victims, obviously, of drone warfare are the people getting blown up and getting their legs blown off and so on. And they do feature in the film, and they have quite an extended section in Afghanistan talking to the victims, but you never get the feeling that they get the same full kind of personhood ascribed to them by the filmmaker. You don't see this sort of rich emotional life that's depicted of the operators and the perpetrators, and I feel like that's actually is playing into the hands of the dehumanization that allows things like the drone program to exist. Because yes, Afghans are in the film, but they're really there just as victims who you know kind of walk around and then get bombed. There's no real feel of what it's like for them, what their lives are like. So I find it difficult.
I see your point, Dan, but one could argue that the role of whistleblowers and journalists, of course, shine a light on these issues, otherwise that would be ignored. And I think Sonia probably emphasises this in the documentary.
Absolutely, and you know, that what they've done to come out against the programme is commendable. But I think even to kind of do justice, if you like, to the operators depicted in the film themselves, you know, what turned them against what they're doing is that at some point they had a realisation, my God, these are human beings that I'm killing. They're just like me or my mom or my neighbour. And I don't think that realisation that's led to them being racked by guilt is fully given to us as a viewer. And I think that's problematic.
Well, that's a really interesting point. We'll have to pause there just for now.
Oh.
I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually push the button. I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. We can't just bomb someone and fly away. We have to follow through. The bomb hit and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see, like, the body parts. You can identify, like, that could be the lower half of his body, and that could be a leg. And then sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or, like, pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket, and a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry him back to their compound.
So it's Heather Leinberg. So you really feel for her in this documentary. Indeed, the other characters also, but she seems to come across as the one most plagued and crippled by guilt for her role in the drone program. Mike, what do you make of how her character is portrayed?
Well, she's not a million miles away from the Ethan Hawke character in Good Kill, the feature film that came out a couple of years ago, in that, you know, she was very much in the room watching this footage come in. And the sense that I got from her watching this film is that it's very different from being a soldier on the ground. If you're a soldier on the ground, you know pretty much that you've killed someone if you haven't killed someone. The sense that I get from her, the issues that she's working through are connected to the fact that nobody has told her who she's killed, how many people she's killed. This is hanging over her. And you get a sense of this issue bearing down on her. It's like she's got something over her head. And that is a very powerful thing.
And Dan, I know you say the true victims are, of course, the targets of the drone strikes. But in this documentary, you see Heather and the others almost come across as victims in their own right, and perhaps particularly connected to the US military's recruitment campaigns. I mean, it's sold off, as you see, as a glorious sort of career you could have, and that you're on the right side of history and justice. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
No, certainly, they are victims as well. They're, I mean, secondary victims, I would say, but certainly, I mean, they're recruited into it pretty much as children, and to talk about the majority of drone operators being 18 to 24, so they're recruited at 18, practically children, but they'll be kind of groomed, effectively, from 16, 17. If you think about the involvement of the Pentagon with the video games industry, they're really being groomed from the age of whenever they start playing video games, 8, 7, 6, into this, into this role. So it's really, it is a form of institutional child abuse within America, you know, what America's doing to its own children, and here in this country, in Britain as well, same thing. Certainly, and of course they're sold, as you say, the idea of being on the right side of history. One of the people involved in the program said,
they had this real sense of moral righteousness, and that they set out to do the right thing. Yeah. They had good intentions at heart.
Exactly, but it's it is child abuse, and you see the impact, and the fact that they're not even allowed to talk to therapists because the therapists don't have security clearance. So the other thing that they would want to discuss is classified, and so on. So absolutely, the treatment of them by the military is shocking, and you hear testimony from Heather. In the film that her kind of commanding officers were constantly questioning her judgment. She was saying, I think there's women and children here and so on. And they're saying, are you sure? I don't think so. Let's fire anyway. And being overruled and so on. Absolutely. There's, they are victims as well. I just don't think they're the primary victims.
That's a good point. And Mike, I just really quickly want to talk about the shots that are used in this documentary. We see a lot of aerial shots. And do you think the director did this intentionally to give the Western viewer the sense of what it's like to be watched? Because a lot of the shots are in US